Well, if you do go up on the roof, don't jump. It always gets better, believe me. We're going to be back in a moment with your calls. James Rickards, as we talk about his work, The Death of Money, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Jim Rickards with us. Just heard that spot for you, Jim. You're everywhere these days. My gosh.
Yeah, that's one of the, one of the sponsors who very happy they buy the book, and then they use it to promote various things. So glad to hear that ad on the show.
So tell me about some of the missing things that they were telling us about.
Well, the paperback version of The Death of Money is coming out in March. The book that's out right now is the hardback, but there's a new chapter in the paperback. The missing chapter is something I wrote for the sponsor. But look, a lot of it involves financial war. A lot of it is going on right now. You know, I talked about the confrontation with Russia. You know, of course, everyone knows Russia invaded Crimea. They peeled off a couple of republics in the eastern part of Ukraine. Nobody thinks there should be a military response to that. We're not going to, you know, put boots on the ground in Crimea anytime soon, nor should we, in my view. But the U.S. doesn't want to do nothing. So we're responding with financial warfare, various forms of economic warfare. But, George, if you go back to the Cold War, there was a doctrine called mutual assured destruction.
Destruction, that's right. We basically both said, look, we're going to destroy each other. Let's not launch.
Right, but there was a time when you said, well, if I launch first and I wipe out the other guy, I win. So that was actually an unstable situation. So what countries did is they built more missiles, saying, well, even if you shoot first, you'll wipe out most of my missiles, but I'll have enough left to shoot back and I'll wipe you out. We used to call this two scorpions in a bottle. You know, one scorpion stings the other. The victim's going to die, but has just enough strength left to sting back, and they both die. So what we have now is mutual assured financial destruction. I've said all along that these sanctions aimed at Russia will not go very far, and they haven't, because Russia has an enormous capacity to strike back. Russia could close the New York Stock Exchange. And if you think that sounds like an exaggeration, the FBI and Homeland Security found a Russian military attack virus inside the NASDAQ operating system in 2010. This was documented by Bloomberg Business Week magazine.
You're talking about hacking.
Talking about hacking, but these are viruses that are implanted that are sleepers. They sit there, and they can be activated after the fact. So it's not just this isn't about stealing credit card numbers or doing financial fraud. This is implanting viruses with time delay fuses inside operating systems or stock exchanges, so they can shut them down when they want. So investors have enough to worry about, but this is just one more thing to think about. By the way, it's one of the reasons I recommend some gold. By the way, I don't believe in going all in on gold or 100%. That's nonsense. I recommend, you know, maybe 5 to 10% for the investor, but physical gold. Gold is not digital. You can't hack it. You can't wipe it out with a computer, so it'll hold up and preserve wealth in every state of the world. August 22nd, 2013, the NASDAQ was closed for half a day. To this day, we've never been offered a credible explanation as to what happened. Now, I want to suggest that if there was some computer problem in NASDAQ, they would have told us, but if it was an attack virus, there'd be good reason not to tell us because investors would be panicked. So that's the kind of thing that's going on behind the scenes, and I talked about that in this missing chapter, but also in the paperback version of The Death of Money, which is coming out in a couple months.
All right, let's go to the calls. We'll take some stories, questions for you. We go to Mount Clemens, Michigan. Mike's with us, first-time caller. Mike, go ahead. You're on with us.
Wow, thank you very much, George. I'm honored to be the first. I am a first-time caller and the first caller of the night. So
you got it.
Mr. Rickards, it's a true pleasure to talk with you as well. I've got a couple quick questions. One is about the Washington Agreement. Back in 05, 06, and 07, there were 13 countries that were signatories to an agreement called the Washington Agreement. I'm sure Mr. Rickards is familiar with. They all agreed to, it's kind of an oxymoron, because the agreement says that they combined, the 13 countries would sell no more than 500 tons of gold a year into the market to keep the, I believe the intention was to keep the price down, because when you flood the market with a product, the price goes down. But it all, what it meant was that they had to sell 500 tons a year. So there were countries like Spain, Germany, Greece, as well as the BRICS, that were all parties to the agreement, and they were selling gold into the market at $500 and $600 an ounce. Now, my question is, how financially, to me, ignorant that is, and how do they justify today increasing their gold reserves at $1,300 an ounce or higher, because a couple years ago, last year was more, when they were selling it at $500 and $600 an ounce. How do they justify that? Okay. And how brilliant do they look now? And number two, I also wanted to ask about the Shanghai Commodity Exchange. Jim Sinclair, I heard, is a chairman of the Shanghai Commodity Exchange, which is for the Chicago Merc and the London Bullion Exchange. Everybody knows how corrupt they are. They think they're drained gold in the price suppression scheme that they've been doing. They think they're out of gold completely. But I heard that the Shanghai market that Jim Sinclair is the chairman of is to compete, and they haven't brought that online yet. And I wanted to know if he's heard anything about that and how that's coming.
Okay, two questions for you, Jim. Go ahead.
Sure. That first thing you mentioned, Mike, the Washington Agreement, has another name, the Central Bank Gold Agreement, and you're exactly right. This was an agreement among major countries to limit sales to 500 tons a year. These were five-year agreements, and they were re-upped every couple of years. So there's one from 99 to 04, another one from 2004 to 2009, and then it was renewed again from 2010 to 2014. Now, this was a cap on sales that they wanted to sell. They were not forced to sell. They wanted to sell because the notion was that gold didn't have any value. It played no role in the monetary system. It looks completely foolish in hindsight. They were, you know, the most famous example, England sold two-thirds of their gold at about $200 an ounce in the late 90s. So of course, today gold is $1,200 an ounce. So they left $1,000 an ounce on the table on several hundred tons. So that looks completely ridiculous. But this was orchestrated. This was selling gold. Now, the thing that intrigues me is not who was selling gold, because we know the answer. Who was buying the gold? And the answer is a lot of it was going to China. Now, that's part of something that is more orchestrated, because the world needs a rebalancing. Between 1950 and 1970, the United States lost 11,000 tons of gold. We had 20,000 tons in 1950.
What do you mean lost? Where'd it go?
We had 20,000 tons in 1950. We were down to 9,000 tons in 1970. So the 11,000 tons, where did it go? It went to our trading partners, 3,000 tons to Germany, 2,000 tons to France, 2,000 tons to Italy, and so on. In other words, they ran surpluses of dollars. In those days, not true today, but in those days, you could take the dollars, cash them in, and get the gold, at that time, $35 an ounce. So that's where the gold went. Now, flash forward 30 years. Who's the big trading surplus? It's China. But they can't get the gold. They can only get, you know, treasury bills and paper money or digital money. So they're a little angry that they can't get the gold the way Europe did. But they are buying it on the market, but the market's very thin. So you need these big sellers to shift the gold over to China. But this is all getting ready for something. This is rebalancing Chinese reserves away from paper money towards gold so that they can reestablish the new financial system, and of course I talk about this in my book. Now, just to kind of finish up on the Washington Agreement, a very funny thing happened. They do have a new agreement. It does limit gold sales, but nobody's selling. Now, the agreement is practically a dead letter because they all realized they blundered when they sold it. They sold it too low, and now nobody's selling. In fact, people who are buying are trying to get the gold back. So the whole thing has turned around. On the second point, I haven't really focused on the Shanghai Commodity Exchange. I've focused a lot more on the Shanghai Gold Exchange.
Yeah.
That's a physical gold exchange. And what's going on? China says, hey, we're the big buyer. We're going to have the biggest stockpile. They are moving the center of gold trading in the world from London to Shanghai. And they're actually changing the standards. Until recently, the standard was a 400-ounce bar of about what's called 3/9 purity, so 99.9% pure, 400 ounces, give or take. China has set a new standard. It's a 1 kilo bar of 4/9 purity, meaning 99.99% pure. So this is the new standard. All the gold trading is going to China. I've actually been to refineries in Switzerland where they said, you know, they're taking 400-ounce bars in the door, melting them down, recasting them, re-refining them as 1 kilo bars and shipping them to China. They're working 24 hours a day. They're doing triple shifts. Every refinery in Switzerland is working flat out. Again, I've been there. I don't just do this on the screen. I've actually visited the vaults, visited the refineries, talked to people who drive armored cars, looked at the physical movement of gold around the world. And it's going to China as fast as they can, make it.
Okay, next up, let's go to Caroline in New York. Welcome to the program. Caroline, go ahead.
Oh, hey. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm going to throw you a couple of big thoughts and see if you have any comments on anything. They're basically concerned, I don't know if you've probably heard of what's called in Neil Keenan lawsuits and how I think it probably relates to the 9/11 financial crimes. It seems that around World War II, a bunch of Asian, there was a huge family trust that held multi-billions dollars of gold, and they were pretty much, in hindsight, duped into turning the gold over to the Federal Reserve under the theory that if nobody has any gold, there's nothing for the world to fight over. So they were given treasury bonds or bills that were finding out purposefully made to look counterfeit and basically uncashable. They would, for 50 years, they were told you can borrow against them, and now the 50 years was up in the late 90s, and when they tried to, you know, get their money, get their gold, you know, physically returned, they were just told no, and it's causing a whole bunch of problems in the world. And part of the 9/11 financial crimes is there was a whole bunch of gold under the World Trade Center that disappeared. Some people claim train loads of it were taken out after the bombing, and then the where the first whatever bomb hit inside the office towers, that was the offices, I don't know if it was Marshall McLellan or the other company, they held all the paperwork and computer, you know, data relating to these treasury bonds and stuff, which further made the situation, you know, the bonds uncatchable, and, you know, so that's just seems to be causing a lot of, you know, behind the scenes financial wars where, you know, people are even claiming that.
All right. And Carolyn, how about a question?
Well, they're claiming that the Federal Reserve or people, you know, who don't want to give the gold back are causing, you know, earthquakes in Japan and all kinds of other, you know, garbage.
Well, how sinister do they get here, Jim?
Well, here's the thing. I'm not familiar with that particular set of allegations, but I can say two things in response. Number one, around World War One, the central banks purposely switched to these 400-ounce bars that I mentioned earlier. This is very well documented. In the 19th century, people would actually walk around with gold coins in their pocket. If you had a one-ounce gold coin at the time, that was worth about $20. Of course, $20 at that time was worth probably $1,000 today. It was a lot of money. People actually walked around with coins in their pockets, not always, but sometimes. And central banks were trying to back up more and more paper money with less and less gold. And one of the tricks they used, again, this is totally factually documented, and I can point the listeners to books and documents, is they say, well, let's kind of collect the coins and turn it into 400-ounce bars. Nobody's going to walk around with a 400-ounce bar in their pocket. It weighs like 35 pounds, right? So they did concentrate it in the vaults. They did turn it into these bars. So the gold is still there, but people no longer had it in their pockets, and they had to accept paper money. So that's a well-documented version of, I think, what Caroline's referring to. I'm not familiar with that particular story she related, but the basic idea that central banks wanted to get the gold in their own possession, give people paper money, and convert the gold to a form that would not be convenient to carry around, that is absolutely true.
All right, it's Ben's turn now. Let us go to Scottsdale, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Ben, you're on with Jim Rickards. Go ahead.
Good morning, sirs. I had a question. I don't know much about this, but Jim, have you ever heard of Islamic slash Sharia finance? What I do know, and do you see any of it coming in the near future or future at all? What I mean by Islamic slash Sharia finance, from what I've heard, their big emphasis is no usury. Usury is a sin in Islam, meaning
it is.
Not using
no
debt,
interest,
not buying things with debt. You know, that sort of thing. There's a lot more to it that I don't know. But just in general, do you see Islamic Sharia-style finance playing a role in the future? Because I'm hearing it touted as a sort of collapse-proof, or at least get you out of the collapse measure to go Sharia and go away from debt and usury.
Well, Ben, actually, I'm an expert on Sharia finance and not all Islamic law, but the part of Sharia is just an Arabic word. It means Islamic law. I'm not expert on all Islamic law, but I am an expert on Sharia finance. I actually was sent by Citibank to Pakistan in the early 1980s to convert Citibank's operations to Sharia finance. I talked about this in chapter one of my book, The Death of Money, This was at the time, Zia al-Huq was the dictator of Pakistan. Remember, in 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini took over Iran and declared it an Islamic Republic. Well, Pakistan had been an Islamic Republic since its founding in 1947, so they felt that they had to sort of, you know, bring up their cred, if you will, their credibility, and be more Islamic than the Iranians. So they declared that all banking operations had to be Islamic compliant or Sharia law. I was working for Citibank in New York at the time, 399 Park Avenue, and I was asked, and this was a shock to the bank because we had big operations in Karachi and Lahore and elsewhere, and I was asked to go out there and sort of come up the learning curve, become expert on Sharia finance and help the bank convert its operations in accordance with local law. The reason I mention that story is that 20 plus years later, after 9/11, this is why the intelligence community reached out to me to help them with counterterrorism, because I was one of the few Western experts on Islamic law. And, of course, the terrorists were they had to finance their operations. I mean, you see this with the Islamic State today. The Islamic State, people call it ISIS or ISIL, but I call it the Islamic State because that's what they call themselves. They just announced 2 weeks ago that they were going to start minting gold, silver, and copper coins, because they don't want to deal in paper dollars anymore, because in Arabic the word is haram. Haram means prohibited. Halal means permitted. So they don't want any currency that's haram. I recently went down to Tampa to meet with United States Special Operations Command. They're based down there at MacDill Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
I was working with the operators on interdicting Islamic finance because, believe it or not, the Islamic State is using Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. So they're using the oldest form of money, which is gold, and the newest 21st century form of money, which are cryptocurrencies, to finance their operations because they have to buy weapons and supplies. So short answer to your question is Islamic finance basically charges no interest, does not allow the payment of interest. It's more like a partnership. It is prevalent in certain parts of the world. There are big centers in Dubai and also Malaysia. It is growing. It has advantages and disadvantages. Technically, it can be more stable because you don't have the leverage that we have in the Western banking system. So a portfolio of those types of, and by the way, you don't have to be a Muslim and you don't have to be Sharia compliant to have a portfolio of hard assets that's not leveraged. I mean, some of it's just common sense. I would also remind listeners that in Christianity, going back 1,000 years or over 1,000 years, interest was prohibited in Christian theology up until the Middle Ages. Now that changed, but
changed in a big way, Jim, didn't it?
Sorry?
Changed in a big way.
Changed in a big way, and who knows what the Italian Florentine bankers had to do with that. They were controlling, they were pretty involved in picking the Pope at the time, but my point being that if you go back in history, there was a time when Islam and Christianity both prohibited interest. In fact, for that matter, if you look at the Jewish religion, the book of Leviticus talks about the Jubilee, which was a debt forgiveness. So all three major religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, at various times in their scriptures, have warned about a leverage, excessive debt, and interest. So I find that interesting that that's one thing all the major religions agree on.
Hold on, Jim. We're coming back with final phone calls for you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, would you want some incredible survival techniques? Watch our television program this week. It's beyond belief. You simply go to this website. You can sign up to watch it and watch a whole bunch of programs while you're there at www.beyondbelief.com. Welcome back to Coast to Coast, back with Jim Rickards, of course, The Death of Money, and your final phone calls here. Jim, in terms of what you do for your own personal life, how do you handle it? Much like what you talk about in The Death of Money?
Yeah, I sort of put my money where my mouth is. I have some gold. I have some land. Actually, one of my best performing investments is fine art.
I like to say that fine art behaves the way gold would behave, except for the manipulation. You know, Janet Yellen doesn't wake up in the morning and say, we really got to hammer the art market today, so it just kind of goes its own way. I don't own any public equities. I don't own any publicly traded equities. I do have some venture capital and some private equity, so I've invested in a few startup tech companies where I know the owners, and you know, I'm kind of a early stage investor, so I like that. So there is, and I have a lot of cash, and people are surprised to hear me say that, because they say, well, gee, Jim, you're the guy talking about the class of money. Why would you have cash? Well, the answer is I might not have it forever, but I like having it for right now for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's a good deflation hedge. You need your inflation hedge, which is the gold and the land and the fine art, but you also need a deflation hedge, which is where the cash comes in. Cash also has it reduces the volatility of everything else you have in your portfolio. It also gives you a lot of optionality. If things fall apart, you can be the guy with the cash. You can go out and pick up some bargains. So that's what I call the barbell approach. You have some hard assets over here, but you have some cash over there, and you're kind of ready for anything. By the way, the guy who's doing that is Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett has been going out buying railroads, oil, natural gas, and a lot of hard assets. But he also has $55 billion of cash, which is the most he's ever had. So he's got the same thing. He's got a few more zeros than I do, but it's the same basic idea.
Where do you keep that kind of cash, James? You can't keep it in your mattress.
Don't keep it in the mattress. I do keep it in the bank, but I stick with the too-big-to-fail bank. I think the too-big-to-fail is a rotten doctrine, but it is the way things operate.
But it's the way it is. That's right.
You know, you do have to be prepared for when they, you know, freeze the accounts. And, you know, you have to stay below the insured amount. If you have more than that, spread it out among multiple banks. So the insurance amount is $250,000. But if you have $1 million, you know, put it in four banks at $250 each, and that way everything's insured. But if you put the whole $1 million in one bank, you're taking a lot of risk on everything over $250. So spread it out in $250 chunks. You know, just be prepared for the day when maybe they shut the banks or reprogram the ATM so you only get $300 a day for gas and groceries. I mean, those kinds of things can happen. They've happened before. They happened in Cyprus not too long ago, and they could be coming to the United States if things get bad enough.
Good point. Okay, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Bill in Baja on the international line. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air with us. Go ahead.
I have a couple questions, but the first one is, a couple years ago, Germany, they sent their guy over here to get a visual and physical check of the gold in the Federal Reserve. I don't know if you remember that, but we sent him away with a sexual assault charge, and he never saw the gold. So do you really think there's gold down there? Because a lot of people don't believe there's any gold left. We know there's none in Fort Knox, but we're not sure about down there in the Federal Reserve. So what do you think about that?
Well, my best information is the gold is there. You know, I always find it sort of curious when people say, you know, this is all a big conspiracy, the gold's not really there, and it's so valuable they have to manipulate the price. Well, if it was that valuable, why would they let it out of their sight? So the gold is there. Now, there's a lot of misunderstanding about leasing. A lot of that gold is leased. And again, this is not conspiracy theory stuff. You can document it. It's in my book, The Death of Money. You go to the footnotes of the Bank for International Settlements. By the way, the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, they're a bunch of nice guys. They're in Basel, Switzerland. That's the central banker's treehouse. That's where they all go hang out.
That's where they hide and play.
That's right. But during World War II, the BIS actually brokered Nazi gold, gave the Nazis hard currency for Nazi gold so they could buy arms to kill U.S. troops. But the president of the bank at the time was an American, Thomas McKittrick. So that shows you how those guys operate. But if you look at the footnotes in their financial statements, it's really geeky, but you can find the evidence of the leasing activity. But a lot of people think when banks lease the gold, you know, they back up a truck and take it away. They don't. I mean, the gold stays there. It's just a paper transaction. But if you're the lessee, now you've got title, and you can go sell 10 times as much to the market, and people don't read the fine print in the contracts. If they actually did read the fine print, they would find that they have what's called unallocated gold, which is a fancy way of saying you don't actually have bars with serial numbers on them. You just have a claim, and when push comes to shove, you got to collect on the claim. They're going to cancel the contract and send you a check. So there's a lot of stuff people don't really kind of read the fine print, but the gold is there. But you know, in terms of you know, Germany, they have not been able to get their gold back. By the way, a lot of those bars in the Federal Reserve, they've been there since the 1920s. And some of those bars are pretty funky. I mean, they're gnarly. They're not the 4.9s purity that the Chinese are insisting on. They might be, you know, some of them are probably 91-92% gold, not even 2.9s or 3.9s. If you'd have to sort of take that gold, melt it down, and send it to a refinery to ship it to Germany to meet their requirements. But here's the dirty little secret about the German, that when the Germans wanted their gold back, the Germans didn't actually want their gold back. The Deutsche Bundesbank, which is their central bank, said they wanted the gold. But remember, a year ago in September, Angela Merkel was up for election.
Yeah.
And she tried to put a coalition together, and some of the parties were saying, we want the gold back. So they put that request in to appease those parties to get some votes. But once the election was over, they kind of quietly dropped it. They don't want the gold. The reason they want the gold in New York is because that's where the leasing activity is. That's where the price manipulation is. If you put the gold in Germany, there's no leasing market in Germany. So that's the end of the manipulation. So the dirty little secret is the Germans actually want their gold in New York so they can participate in the manipulation.
What an incredible game they play, James.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go to Sharon in Crane, Missouri. Hi, Sharon. I'm glad you got in. Go ahead.
Hi. Mr. Rickert, I've got an idea that I've been pushing for a dozen years now, and I've been told I'm everything from stupid to crazy. But there's one resource in this country or in the world that's worth more than anything, and that's water. And in this country, we have a series of pipelines, and the rights to the land is already there. We have flooding in this country every single year, and billions of gallons of water are just lost. And I don't understand why we can't do an infrastructure job where we build big reservoirs and refineries to refine the water because of contaminants and ship this water all over the country. And if people don't think that this is practical, well, the governor of Kansas is talking about building an aqueduct from the Missouri River to Kansas to solve Kansas's future water problem. And I really think that if somebody could get the money together and had the brains to do it, that would be an industry that would bust this country wide open.
Well, there's going to be wars over water, Jim. She's right about that.
Well, Sharon, first of all, thanks for the question. You're not stupid. You're not crazy. That's actually a brilliant question and a brilliant observation, and you are just ahead of your time. By the way, I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that in my personal portfolio, I have some venture capital startup-type companies. One of them is a company called Water Fund, LLC, which is working very hard on doing exactly what you're talking about. Water Fund, LLC, is the co-inventor, along with IBM, of something called the Water Cost Index. So think of it as the Dow Jones of water. You know, we all go home at night, we know if the Dow Jones went up 50 points or down 100 points. Well, Water Fund has invented a Water Cost Index for the cost of producing water. Now, here's why that's important. We don't actually have a water scarcity problem. Everyone thinks we do. We don't. There's plenty of water. There's enough water in the Great Lakes to flood the state of California. What we have is an infrastructure problem. The water's in the wrong places. You got to move it from point A to point B.
That's right.
Just take oil for an example. If you want to put gas in your car, you don't go out and drill for oil in your backyard. You go to the gas station. Well, where's that come from? It comes from a refinery. Where's that come from? It comes from probably Nigeria. It was put on a tanker. In other words, the oil industry has had 150 years to build out the infrastructure to get gasoline to your local gas station. The water industry has done nothing of the kind. And you're right, pipes are leaking. More water is wasted through just bad pipe system and bad infrastructure than actually kind of gets to the tap. So there's plenty of water to go around. The problem is infrastructure. That would create a lot of jobs, a lot of investment. But the problem with infrastructure is you need to borrow the money, issue bonds. Well, how do you know what your costs are going to be? Well, you don't. You might not. But you can use this index to hedge your costs. So that's one of the reasons I'm very bullish on this company. So this stuff, it's all new. It's coming. You're absolutely right about the importance of it. But the solution is not to, you know, curl up in a ball and worry about drought. The solution is to move water from where we have it to where it's needed. That means infrastructure. That means finance. And that's where this water cost index comes in. And the company is Water Fund, LLC.
What do you think of desalinization plants all over the country?
Well, desalinization, it has problems. It has costs and benefits. The problem is it's very energy intensive. So, you know, there's no free lunch. So you can write an equation, salt water plus energy equals fresh water. Well, how much energy? Now, you go to a place like Dubai,
or Qatar, you know, Qatar's hosting the World Cup, I think, in 2020. They've got to build 9 brand new indoor air conditioned stadiums. You know how much water?
But they will. They got enough money for that. Right?
They've got the money, but they're kind of wasting it. It's not the best use of the money. You're right. They do have the money, but that's not the best use of it. So one of the biggest water infrastructure projects in the world today is called Red Sea to Dead Sea. They're going to pump salt water from the Red Sea into the Dead Sea, move it overland, raise the water level of the Dead Sea. I was in Jordan recently. The Dead Sea is evaporating.
Oh, it's shriveling up. Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
So they'll raise the water level, kind of restore the Dead Sea. I mean, there's no life in it, but just kind of restore the water table. But then you can build desalinization plants in Jordan and Israel, power both countries, use the water for agriculture, you know, again, as the Israelis have done, make the desert bloom. So that's the kind of very ambitious, big-ticket, multi-billion-dollar water infrastructure projects going on. But you need financing, and that's where this index comes in. So that's one of my, one of my sort of venture capital startup companies.
Let's go next to Chicago, Wayne's turn on Coast to Coast. Wayne, you're up.
Yes, thank both of you gentlemen for all the work that you do.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you, Wayne.
Speaking of water, I want to go to the Keystone XL pipeline. That pipeline, if it's built, will go over one of the largest aquifers in the United States. And we all know that the pipelines always spill. But anyway, my main point is I have some State Department statistics that say that only 35 permanent jobs will be created by starting the Keystone XL pipeline. You have 15 jobs, especially in maintenance, which are basically temporary. So you could say 50 jobs permanent, but the thing is, they say that 10,400 seasonal jobs that last only 4 to 8 months will be created, and it will take 2 years to complete the pipeline. As the actual number of jobs in those 2 years will be 3,900 jobs. So, and the main thing is that dirty tar sands oil, some of the most polluted oil in the world, will be coming down from Canada to Texas. It will not be used in the United States. It will all be shipped on the world market. So it won't affect our price one way or another. But we're dealing with all the pollution that comes with shipping that oil from Canada through Texas. And what I really want to say is, wouldn't we do better by just fixing our infrastructure, which we need $3 trillion in infrastructure? And that would be a better way for United States citizens to get jobs instead of Keystone Pipeline, which only supplies 35 permanent jobs. So what do you think about that, Mr. Rickard?
Well, I'm not an engineer, so I'm not going to challenge the statistics, but I do agree with the basic idea that infrastructure is the way to move the U.S. economy forward. Now, the way to think about that, in my view, is, and I write about this in my book, The Death of Money, you know, not all borrowing is bad. Borrowing can be good or bad. It depends what you do with the money. So bad borrowing is when you can't afford something, you borrow the money to buy it anyway, and you have no idea how you're going to pay the money back. That's bad. But good borrowing is when you can borrow the money, put it to good use, get a higher return than the cost of borrowing it, and maybe do some good in the meantime. Now, when you apply that to government, you got to put on a couple other tests. You have to say, are we borrowing to do something that the private sector cannot do? Because I'd rather leave it to the private sector when you can. But there's some things that have to go to the public sector. So number one, can we afford it? Number two, are we doing something that the private sector really cannot do? And number three, is the expected benefit greater than the cost? If you pass all three tests, then that's a project that ought to get some consideration. And the classic example, of course, is the interstate highway system. I mean, you have some private toll roads, but there's no way private entrepreneurs could have financed the entire interstate highway system. And the benefits of that are enormous. It's been paying off ever since. And that was a good year. It was done by President Eisenhower, started in the 1950s. Of course, it took decades to complete. So there are some projects like that that make sense. So I'm not an engineer. I don't want to, you know, sort of say which project should take precedence over another. But I do know the test to apply. It's the three-part test I just gave you. You know, can you afford it? Does it have a positive return? And is it something the private sector can't do? And if you pass all three tests, with interest rates where they are, we ought to go borrow the money for 10 years. You know, one example I give in the book is, why don't we build a natural gas pipeline adjacent to the interstate highway system and put in gas stations that pump natural gas and convert the diesel fleet, the trucks, over to natural gas. That would take advantage of our natural gas, lower fuel costs, create jobs, put the money to good use, and reduce pollution. So that seems like a win-win-win. Again, that's got to be signed off by experts. But your basic point that there are good infrastructure projects that deserve consideration, I agree with.
Okay, let's go to Jan, Rochester, New York. Get you in here, Jan. Go ahead.
Thank you, George. And,
sure thing.
First-time caller, long-time listener. And
Jim,
thank you for being on the show. I got three quick ones. One question is, where do you predict the silver market to go along when gold is going? Number two, wouldn't it be feasible for the world governments to get together and have one monetary situation going on that's just simply backed by, say, silver, nickel, and copper? And number three, in regards to the water deal, wouldn't it be advantageous to go ahead and start bottling the billions of tons of water that is falling into the ocean off of the coast of Alaska from the glaciers?
Let's go. We've got a minute left. We'll knock them out here. Jimmy,
okay,
go ahead.
Well, silver's going to tag along with gold. So if gold goes up, silver will go up with it. Silver's not going to be left behind. So I'm not as expert on silver, but I do see that price going a lot higher. World money backed by a basket of commodities, that's a very old idea. Maynard Keynes proposed that at the Bretton Woods Conference. It did not prevail. We went to a dollar gold standard, but then we abandoned that along the way. But those ideas have never gone away. So I don't mind world money backed by something. I just don't like world money that they print. You may see that. On the water point, you're absolutely right. I actually work with partners. We have a concession for 100 billion liters a year coming off of glaciers in Patagonia on the Chile side. Same thing in Alaska. But here's the problem. We looked at buying a tanker for about $50 million, a clean hull, filling it up with water, selling the water to Shanghai, mooring it, and having a floating aquifer. But there's a problem with that, which is that when you get there, because the water is subsidized, it's not economic because it's so expensive to move water by sea because of what are called the bunkers or the fuel, that when you get there, if it's subsidized, you're not economic. Now, so what you have to do is get rid of the subsidies and get to the true cost of water. If you can do that, then shipping the water makes sense. But as long as it's going to be subsidized on the receiving end, you're never going to make money, and that water is just going to melt off the glaciers and go into the ocean.
The name of the book is called The Death of Money by Jim Rickards. His website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Jim, always a pleasure having you on the program. You have a great Christmas, okay?
Thank you, George. You too.
Up next, The Alien Hunter on Coast to Coast AM.